Welcome to Season 4 of The Great Humbling. My name's Ed Gillespie, and I'm a futurist, a poet, and a recovering sustainability consultant. In the spring of 2020, during the first lockdown, I began recording a series of conversations with Dougal Hine, co-founder of a school called Home. We started with a question. What if it makes sense to think of ourselves as living in a time of humbling, being laid low, brought down to earth? Pulling on that thread has taken us further and become more central to our work than either of us expected. So we're back now with an open-ended series as part of the wider patchwork of homewardbound.org. Thank you for listening. So it's good to be back. Here we are. It's the middle of March. And I'm always left wondering, almost every year, what on earth happened to February?
Yeah, well, I think it's my fault. I think I lost February. And here's the big reveal. Basically, after 30 years that I've spent, literally 30 years, living inside the old Peter Cook joke, you know, two men at a party. One says, I'm writing a book. The other says, me neither. I need to find a new joke to live inside, because I am, as of this morning, 20 chapters into writing a book that's come together pretty quickly, and I have a publisher, and there's lots more that I will be able to say about this a month or two down the line, I guess. But yeah, basically, I've had my head down, and I completely missed out on us doing a February episode. And I've been, to be honest, I've been quite reticent about talking about the book. My friend Liz Oldfield, who does the Sacred podcast that I've talked about on here before, she asked me if I'd celebrated having a book deal. Because she was like, you know, for as long as I've known you, you've been kind of wrestling with this thing and wanting to write a book and trying to find the right relationship with the publishing industry. And she's only known me 2 years, but literally my oldest friend, Billy, has known me for 30 years and she could say the same thing. But my gut reaction when Liz asked me if I'd celebrated this big threshold was no, because it's not time to celebrate yet. It's like you don't have the harvest festival while the corn is still out in the field. You've got to bring the hay in before you start to make hay in any other senses of the word. And so there'll be lots more to say when the book is written, and I'm working to a deadline a few weeks from now, so all being well, by the time we record our April episode, I'll be out the far side of at least, you know, this first draft. But that's what happened to my February. How about you, Ed? What's been going on at your end of things? Have you done something equally impressive with your February?
Well, yeah, nothing as productive as writing a book. No, I'm very impressed by your hardworking writer's elbow. No, I've been in the process, along with the rest of the Greenpeace UK board, of recruiting a new exec director following the retirement of the legendary John Sovan, who has been in the organisation for 30 years. And it's a really challenging process. I mean, not least because Greenpeace has just turned 50 years old, as I am about to too. And it's a really critical moment for the organisation's role in change in these, you know, increasingly tumultuous times. Especially, you know, when living up to its founding ethos of a green peace, literally, has never felt sharper. And I think it's fascinating when you look at where sort of grassroots activism like XR and Insulate Britain have to some extent stolen Greenpeace's thunder as the radical edge of campaigning protest, which has left Greenpeace looking a bit like a moderate flank in some ways. So that's when you know you're living an interesting time. So finding the right leader to work like both collaboratively and creatively with that wider movement in a new and unprecedented era is a huge task, you know. And it's a job which comes with a relatively modest salary. You've got the joy of aligning dozens of massively committed, sometimes hot-headed activist staff. You've got to wrangle humongous systemic global challenges, and you've got the very real chance of getting arrested and imprisoned. So do you fancy a crack at it, Dougal?
I'll be honest, Ed, I think without giving too much away, once this book is published, any chance that I ever had of being hired by an environmental NGO will be gone. Do you know, in between chapters, I actually did have an idea for an episode that I sent over to you. And it is, it's one I still want to do. It's an episode about belief. But I'm standing here this morning thinking, are we going to talk about Ukraine? What do you reckon, Ed?
I mean, my gut reaction on this is, you know, I think we've all probably had enough of armchair commentators. I think there's a quite a specific insanity to the myriad voices of self-appointed expert opinion that seems to have sort of segued seamlessly from discussing Brexit, you know, to pandemic analysis and now on to Ukraine. And suddenly we're all political strategists, epidemiologists, and now military tacticians, it appears. And I've been sort of ruminating on Douglas Rushkoff, you know, the sort of digital humanist, and something he said last week. And he said, instead of filling our channels and brains with uninformed opinions, we should stop and breathe. You know, we're not there. We're not informed, and we should shut up, except maybe to stand in solidarity with our fellow human beings. We can bear witness to what is happening. Instead of adding more conflict and confusion to the crisis, we can actually help metabolize the trauma of our fellow beings. We are all connected after all. And, you know, that really struck me as a very apposite observation for a lot of the noise.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I particularly like the way that Doug's talking about the metabolic there. If you follow that line back into Vanessa Andreotti's work and the hospicing modernity, you know, there's such a need for something slower. I mean, actually, for me, there's something here that goes back even to the days when I was a professional journalist, because one of the things that crept up on me back then, as I began to realise that I was not going to stay the course as a BBC radio reporter, was this phenomenon where you come in each day and at the start of your shift, you're given a brief. And at the end of the shift, I go on air talking in this authoritative voice about something I had known nothing about 8 hours earlier. And clearly, you know, not all journalists. You know, I have known extraordinary people who work in the medium of journalism whose work goes deep. But if there's something that's worth doing, something that I think is worth talking about here, then maybe it involves talking out of puzzlement rather than certainty. Talking in a way that admits the limits of what we know, the limits of our understanding. And I guess that's what I find myself called back to each time when we hold these conversations in the name of being humbled. So there are a few things that I want to say about what's going on. And I guess it starts with saying that there are layers of horror to the present moment. And in that spirit of bearing witness that Douglas is talking about, the fundamental horror, obviously, inevitably, rightly, is what we feel at what we're glimpsing and the parts that we can only imagine of this war that's been brought to the people of Ukraine. And there's no justification for Russia's invasion or the way its war is being conducted. There's no room for both sidesism.
No, the suppression will be televised.
Really, yeah. And actually, if I switch on the TV here in Sweden, I see our neighbour, literally across the road from us in Östervåla, Sebastian Stakset, the artist formerly known as Sebi Stax. I don't know if I've ever told you this, Ed. We have a reformed gangster rapper who bought the huge...
you haven't dropped that one in.
Right. I mean, we haven't really got to know him properly yet because there's been a pandemic on and it's like not so easy to walk across the road and introduce yourself to your neighbours as it would ordinarily be. But he's now a pastor in the church. He found Jesus, or Jesus found him, one way or the other, and together they've started a home in the former coaching inn, effectively it is, across the road from us here, which is for people who are coming out of rehab and to give people a chance to get their lives back on track somewhere away from the place they were living when it all went wrong. So he's a deeply impressive human being, And right now on Swedish TV, you see him. He drove down to Lviv with a group of doctors. He's been coordinating food and buses for refugees. And I just feel, you know, people and organizations that put themselves in danger, that put themselves on the front line of relief work, deserve admiration and support. And I feel like it's kind of important to put anything that we're doing in comparison, in contrast with that. Like this work of sense-making, for want of a better word, it's questionable at best, and it's often part of the secondary horror. But I have found myself in these weeks called back to what we were doing, you know, 2 years ago when we started this podcast in the spring of 2020, because again, 2 years on, there's this sense of something massive having come out of the corner of almost everyone's field of vision to become the thing that's dominating the news, the feeds, the fears that keep people awake at night. And so I think if we're going to talk about anything, we probably do need to talk about this. But I admit there's a part of me that just wants to shut the fuck up. And I think about these protesters in West Germany in the early 1980s who were opposing the deployment of American nuclear missiles. And their protests involved just silently standing in the streets of the small town where the base was, where the missiles were being brought in. And Ivan Illich was part of that movement, and he wrote a couple of short texts about it. And he said, "To enter into a reasoned discussion about the possible use of nuclear warheads is to participate in an obscenity, and silence becomes the only response that acknowledges what it is that's being talked about."
That potency of silence. So that reminds me of the silent parade by African Americans in New York back in 1917, you know, which was 50 years before the nascent civil rights movement in the US sort of went national and indeed international. And, you know, where thousands of black citizens walked silently, just accompanied by drumbeats through the streets of Manhattan, at least partly inspired by a spate of lynchings and the terror of the East St. Louis race riots. And that quiet solemnity of that march was by all accounts extremely powerful. And it got me thinking also about XR's Red Rebel Brigade, you know, created by Doug Francisco and Justine Squire, with those striking figures draped in red cloth, with their pale faces moving sort of slowly and sinuously and silently as one, in representation of the blood that we all share with each other and other species, which itself was also an evolution of an all-white mime show from the late 90s. It was also part of the anti-Iraq war demonstrations in 2003. And all of those things, like you say, from sort of West Germany to Manhattan to, you know, various different protests of the last couple of years, it's an incredibly powerful, calming, sort of de-escalating presence wherever these silent protests manifest.
Yeah. There's an incredible power in silence. There's an eloquence in silence. And I'm thinking again about Illich because it's a theme that he came back to again and again throughout his writing. And in one of his early texts, he talks about how when you learn a language, if you only learn the words, and you don't learn the silences, there's a violence in stepping into somebody else's language like that. And part of the strangeness of social media is that silence is non-existence. There is no way to bear silent witness on Twitter or on Facebook. There's no way for your silence to mean anything. You just vanish. And L.M. Sakazas, who writes a Substack called The Convivial Society, he was saying something along these lines a while back. And on the one hand, it might seem like an absurd shift of gear to go from talking about the threat of nuclear war to talking about the shortcomings of social media. But I tell you, what came home to me in the past 3 weeks is that we are living in a world where the dysfunctionality of social media and the behaviours it encourages in us has the capacity to take an already horrific situation and escalate it towards becoming a third world war. And to try and talk calmly about that, you know, it's the absurdity of it is we spent 4 years of the Trump presidency with people talking about how horrific it was that someone who couldn't control his outpourings on Twitter had his finger on the nuclear button. And now many of those people are tweeting hashtag clear the skies, like collectively mobilizing Twitter to try and push the global political discourse towards events that would likely escalate into a nuclear war. That's how mad the situation we're in is. And to try and talk calmly about that actually, you know, puts me back in the dilemma of those German anti-nuclear activists 40 years ago.
I know. And it's just, it's inevitably exacerbated, isn't it, by the, you know, the notorious algorithmic selection where every contribution is amplifying that hot, provocative content and literally turning up the heat of the supposed debate to unbearable levels. And I, you know, we used to say, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And now I sense we should just turn the bloody oven off.
Amen. And it is interesting the difference between the kind of fast, hot media and again, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And the slow media that have, we talked about this in the last series, that have kind of evolved often with a bit of a dark forest quality to them, whether it's podcasts like this that mostly have a few hundred listeners per episode or Substacks. And Justin E.H. Smith, who has a Substack, it's called Justin E.H. Smith's Internet. He's a philosopher, he's an American, he's based in Paris, but he's actually someone who really does have a deep knowledge and experience of the countries of the former Soviet Union. You know, he translates Siberian poetry into English, and he's spent serious periods of time there over decades. He wrote a piece where he was looking back to the Iraq War and talking about what's changed in how we voice our response to war. He was talking about he was living in Turkey at the time and taking part in protests there. And he said, in a way, it's the last time he's felt morally certain about anything. And here's what he wrote. He said, "I was morally certain of the injustice of the 2003 US invasion of Iraq and found myself as a result in the strange company of others with whom I often shared very little else politically. I am morally certain of the injustice of the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine as well, but I find myself rather less certain about the utility and the wisdom of onboarding with the opposition. One significant change over the past 20 years is that today the way we express our political commitment is often largely by entering into the pseudo-public sphere known as social media and inserting our views into an algorithmically determined system." You know, that's what you were saying before, Ed. So that to say what you think, and this is Justin Smith still, is in fact something more like upvoting, giving an algorithmic boost, rather than, say, articulating reasons. "It is therefore not because this time around I am not a citizen of the aggressor state that I find myself less than morally certain about how even to express my opposition to Russia's invasion, but because I don't think, say, the question of setting up a no-fly zone is the sort of thing that's best resolved by upvoting or downvoting."
No, exactly. That sort of binary approach. I mean, for me, it's about those inevitable sort of onion layers of history, and it can sometimes feel like the debate at the superficial level, at one level, is so simplified and polarized that we're just skinning the onion. We've only taken the brown peel off the outside. But the more you read and dig and explore and get into the complexities, the convolutions, the nuances, and it makes your positions and the respective positions that people are taking even more compromised. And I think each layer of that onion you remove just reveals another one underneath with politicized machinations, historical grievances, you know, geopolitical power plays, notions of identity. And as you said right at the start, this is in no way a miserable defense of moral equivalence for this war. But it does make you appreciate that the deeper you go, ultimately, there's no core to that onion. It's just more and more layers. And you become unsure, actually, ultimately, what, if anything, actually lies at the heart. You know, the war is supposedly justified in whatever horrendous way by the layers of meaning that we choose to select, and the opposition in a similar way. And by that point, you know, having peeled this onion, you're literally bloody weeping.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I have a strong memory of 2014 when Russia invaded Crimea after the events that had led to the fall of the government in Ukraine and its replacement. And because that spring I was taking Swedish classes and I'd finished the standard Swedish for immigrants program and somehow accidentally talked my way into another program that was actually aimed at immigrants with professional backgrounds from outside of Europe to speed people's integration into Swedish society. So I was the only white European in the group, and most of my classmates, some of whom I still keep in touch with, came from Syria. Mm. And anyway, you have to have the context that Russia feels closer here in Sweden than it does in England. Sweden isn't part of NATO. It's been historically unaligned. And it's a country that makes a shitload of money selling arms while priding itself on not having actually fought a war in two centuries.
Yeah, the last Swedish war was against Norway.
Yeah, I mean, talk about picking a tough opposition. But, right, we're right next door to Finland, which did fight a war against the Soviet Union in the 1940s and lost part of Karelia, the Finnish cultural heartland, according to a lot of people, in that war. And my mother-in-law comes from Karelia. Her parents met during the Winter War, and her father was finally able to return to visit his family village in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it's an extraordinary story, because he went to visit the graves in the village churchyard, and that night, at the hotel, he had a heart attack and died.
Oh, I mean, yeah, the return of exiled kin to the place of their kith. Maybe that is literally enough to break your heart.
Yeah. And, you know, it's things like that that I find coming to the fore, whether it was those experiences within, you know, the generations of our family or the experiences of my friends who I met in language classes that come to the fore for me as I watch the pictures of people now being displaced and not knowing how long it will be before they come home. I mean, I remember going to Sarajevo in 2005. 10 years after the war, and meeting people who had literally, you know, when the war in Bosnia started, gone to visit cousins in Denmark for a week, assuming they'd be back once things calmed down, and then spent years watching on TV as their country tore itself apart. Mm. So yeah, Russia feels closer in this part of the world than it did when I lived in England. For all that we grew up knowing that its missiles were pointed in our direction and ours or the Americans in its direction. And you know, famously, a few years ago, the Swedish military acknowledged that its total capacity would extend to being able to hold two counties for a week in the event of an invasion.
Yeah, I remember being on an island in Sweden in like the autumn of 2014 when there was one of those scares on in regard to alleged sightings of a Russian submarine in the archipelago. And I remember Swedish friends, you know, everyone was gossiping about the fact that there have been these sightings of a mysterious submersible, you know, creeping around the fringes.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, Russian submarines are a bit like the UFOs of Swedish rationalist culture. They exist in some kind of quantum binary transposition state where until you open the lid of the sea, which you can't do, you don't know whether they're really there or not, but everyone's talking about them. So I'm sat in this classroom in 2014 with my classmates, most of whom have fled the war in Syria. And there's all this buzz in the Swedish news about Russia and what's going on in Ukraine. And people are trying to make sense of the news that's coming to us in a language that we're still learning. And I remember one of my classmates asked the teacher, are the Russians going to invade Sweden? And the teacher said, well, Putin's a madman. He could do anything. And I remember thinking that was a terrible answer. And the last thing you should say to someone for whom war and the threat of war is as real as it was for most of the people in that classroom. But, you know, this is someone whose job is teaching Swedish to immigrants. They're not a historian or a political analyst. They're just passing on what they hear on the news or in conversations at the pub. But I remember talking about it in the coffee break, though, and saying, look, there are reasons for what's going on in Ukraine, and I'm not pretending to know all of them, but there is a history to it. It's not something that's just going to happen here because Putin wakes up one day with the idea of invading Sweden.
Yeah, it's back to the onion of history, isn't it? I mean, I read that Jacobin piece you shared by Branko Marketic, and I was struck by the sheer mess of even the relatively recent history of the situation, which your point about major issues suddenly lurching from the periphery into center stage makes the current horror show, I mean, it's not explicable, but perhaps imaginable. And I think that failure of imagination works both ways. Our inability to conceive of both better and much worse. And I think it was Nobel laureate Thomas Mann who once observed, war is only a cowardly escape from the problems of peace. And what feels clearer, at least in hindsight, is that the so-called peace of the last few years under the Minsk Accords was riven with problems. You know, and whilst this war is an inhuman, unjustifiable, and indeed bullying and cowardly escape from those supposedly intractable forces of the problems of peace, it's happening in a place that Marketic describes as full of shadowy motives, shifting allegiances, and where little is what it seems on the surface. And that really chimed with me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that piece is worth reading if you want a sober and deeply informed perspective on how and why these events have come about. And just a sense, I mean, I think it was Gordon White who said this, a sense that history didn't start 3 weeks ago. Mm. So here's a question. How do wars end? Because again, when I dip into the buzz on social media and actually some of the things that I've heard Western politicians saying, it feels like we've got wars confused with Hollywood movies. We think they end with evil being vanquished and good being vindicated. We want this to end in a fortnight with Putin dead or overthrown or in a court in The Hague.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Jeremy Corbyn, bless him, remember him, who said all wars end in negotiation, so why don't we just skip the fighting and go straight for the agreement?
I always thought that Jeremy Corbyn, in many ways, I didn't think he embodied the kind of radical Marxist ultra-left politics that his opponents claimed that he did. But he always reminded me of my mum's take on the world, which is not a bad thing. But yeah, I mean, wars end around negotiating tables, if everyone is lucky. Or worse, they don't end. They roll on for 10 or 20 years, long after Twitter has stopped paying attention to them.
Yeah, I mean, indeed, many people have made that point, haven't they, in regard to, you know, Syria, Yemen, they're in Eritrea, and the list goes on of those other sort of rumbling conflict.
Right. And I guess this is another layer in my reaction to the thing that Justin Smith is describing, the social media cheerleading, because I have a sharp memory of the spring of 2011 as the Arab Spring began to escalate. And there was a night when I was sitting in the dark in a studio in Brussels, unable to sleep, watching the hashtags stream down the columns on TweetDeck. And it hit me how easy we all seem to find it to cheer others on to rise up against an authoritarian regime when it's not our bodies that are going to be on the line. And I tried to say something about this, and someone shot back saying, do you not realise the world is already at war? And they were talking about Iraq and Afghanistan, but my reaction was, if you can't see that things could get far worse than they already are, then it's that failure of imagination you mentioned earlier. Like Vinay Gupta always says, yeah, another world is possible, but a much, much worse world is also possible. And I wrote about this somewhere. That night, I had this glimpse of our generation on Twitter being the equivalent of the crowds at railway stations cheering off the soldiers on their way to the trenches. And, you know, I say lots of things about social media. I hardly say anything on social media anymore. But there have been moments in the past 3 weeks when a little bit of me was tempted to post, if you ever wondered what you'd have done in August 1914, you're doing it now.
Mm.
And needless to say, I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something here, not in defense of those cheerleaders online, but by way of attempting an explanation, which is connected to this feeling of powerlessness.
Mm.
You know, when you've had this sort of nuclear saber rattling of Putin, which seems to sort of compel the West and NATO into a de-escalatory position. You know, it's a very kind of threatening strong arm tactic, which is less about the sort of shared, although flawed, logic and lunacy of, you know, the era of mutually assured destruction as a deterrent. And actually it feels more like what you might call spit, which is the sort of self-proclaimed impunity of terror, where, you know, we are forced to literally watch civilians and civil infrastructure being systematically killed and destroyed. And inevitably that leads to a deep sense of shame and horror and impotence. And I think that need to do something is really urgent and obviously a little bit unhinged at times. I mean, in a positive way, you know, you get almost 100,000 British people rushing to offer Ukrainian refugees rooms in their houses, you know, far, far greater appetite than the government even aimed to tolerate in its own foot dragging of opening up visas and opportunities. And all of the outpouring of donations, both financial and material, that you always get in these situations, all of which perhaps alongside the empathy and bearing witness that we've been talking about mean infinitely more than that, you know, essentially unwinnable online information war. And there are a couple of things, you know, that have really stood out for me. I mean, amongst all the kind of frenetic activism, I was really touched by the story of two Scottish landscape gardeners who, you know, literally got in their car and drove to Ukraine up to Sumy in the northeast of the country and rescued, you know, three black students, one Irish and two Nigerian. I mean, it was completely mad, but so human. Just like, we're just going to go and do this. And they did. And they're going to go and do it again.
That's what it means to care.
Yeah.
You know, someone asked Illich, don't you care about the children starving in Africa? And he said, no, look, like, to care would mean that I would get up and sell the things in this room and take the money and travel there and do something. And we cannot go around using the word care to express a sort of a self-satisfied, warm feeling of virtue as we look on the suffering of others. That's not what care means. You know, your guys who get in the car, that's the Samaritan of the New Testament. That's what caring means. But there's another layer here that we need to talk about, and that's, why this war? Why is it Ukraine that has seized our collective imagination and become the only thing in the news? And if you want to throw this into relief, then there's an article by the Yemeni journalist Ahmed Abdul Karim, the title of which says it all. Tears for Ukraine, sanctions for Russia, yawns for Yemen, arms for Saudis.
Mm.
You know, you already touched on this. Like, people have been bringing this up. But since 2015, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia has carried out over 266,000 airstrikes on Yemen. Over 400,000 people have been killed. It's not just that what's being done to Yemen has never received a fraction of the coverage of what's being done to Ukraine. It's that we've literally had Boris Johnson this week going to Saudi Arabia to ask them to help Europe wean itself off Russian oil by increasing the amount of oil that they're supplying. So it's not okay to buy oil from Russia because that funds its war on Ukraine, but it's fine to fund the Saudi war on Yemen.
Yeah, I mean, as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sometimes rhymes. And you can hear that chorus of hypocritical couplets being recited in regard to the grotesque double standards, you know, being dramatically and inconsistently applied at our convenience, or in this case, you know, our rather awkward energetic inconvenience in terms of our energy supplies. I mean, what's almost 100 summary executions between friends?
Right. Yeah. So again, why this war? Why is it? What is it about Ukraine that commands our attention? And there are a couple of obvious answers. And the first one, I'm sorry to be blunt, but it's that in Ukraine, the people being bombed are white. Al Jazeera had a fierce article by the Kenyan cartoonist Patrick Gatara that I want to read you a bit of this because it just gives you a sense of how this all might look from a country in Africa. The conflict raging in Ukraine between Russian and Ukrainian Slavs, the latter with the support of a tribal coalition of nations across sub-Scandinavian Europe, has exposed much more than the fragility of peace on the disease-ravaged subcontinent. It has also revealed a mean streak of racist exceptionalism with which many Europeans and people of European heritage tend to regard themselves. Mm. It has been impossible to miss the shock among Caucasian journalists covering the war, sparked by Russians' invasion under the pretext of supporting ethnic allies in the eastern tribal enclaves of Donetsk and Luhansk, which it has recognized as independent states, at the idea that this could happen in Europe. And, you know, what you've got there is that voice, that authoritative voice of the foreign correspondent being turned around so we recognise all of the assumptions contained in the way that we usually hear it used.
Mm.
So, yeah, part of why this war is just racism. You go through the coverage and there are numerous variations on the theme of, but they look like us.
I know, it's that sense of blinking disbelief you can hear from the journalists, isn't it? The word civilised, I know, has come up a lot too, that this is happening in civilised Europe, you know, not by crude inference, some other uncivilised part of the world where war is somehow inevitable.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, and another part of it is fear. Because Russia is a world power with a huge stockpile of nuclear weapons, you alluded to earlier. And there is the sense that this could escalate into something that hardly bears imagining. And if anything, that deserves to be taken more seriously than it has been until now.
Oh, and I know. And this is, I watched a fascinating talk by Vladimir Posner, who's a French-born Russian-American journalist. And it's a talk he gave at Yale University in 2018 called How the US Created Putin. And, you know, it's very weirdly prescient when you sort of watch this back in hindsight 4 years down the road. But one of the key points he made by way of warning was how seemingly blithe and indifferent we've become in regard to that threat of nuclear weapons and how deeply worrying that was. He just said, you know, it's like we don't care anymore.
Yeah, I remember how it hung over us. You must remember this too as kids in the 80s. And it's true that we kind of, I don't know what metaphor to use, took our eye off the ball isn't quite right. But, you know, the world's attention shifted elsewhere after the end of the Cold War, as if they weren't all still there sleeping in their bunkers. But there is another strand here as well, I think. It's not just the racism of, they look like us. It's, they want to be like us. There's something here I want to try and draw out. It's about how this war plays into or cuts across our stories about the shape of history. Maybe I can get there via a piece that Reid Wildermuth wrote on, again, on Substack. It's called The Haunted Mansion of Modern Freedom. And he's talking about this other layer to the horror that people in the West are experiencing over Ukraine. And again, he starts by making that first point that has to be made. Here's what he says. What Putin is doing to Ukraine is morally indefensible. But what he has done to the fantasy of historical progress, urban civic religion, and the Pax Capitalis is the unspoken crime against which most people are unconsciously reacting now. Kiev is a city like London or San Francisco, full of professional managerial class sorts with LinkedIn profiles and TikTok accounts. They drink lattes on their way to their IT jobs. They Netflix and chill American sitcoms. They walk their dogs in city off-leash parks, and they post photos of their daily lives on Instagram as influencers or just regular users.
Yeah, no, I was with the Forward Institute up in Manchester, and I sat in a bar on the 23rd floor of a new tower block in Deansgate on the night that the war started. And I was, you know, it was a intensive facilitation week, and I was just grabbing like half an hour to myself. And I was looking out over this twinkling metropolitan skyline, thinking that exact thought, you know, what would it be like to see explosions on the horizon, trying to empathize with that situation in Kyiv, which hours earlier had been just like Manchester.
Right. So that piece from Reed, he took the title from Deepesh Chakrabarty's essay, The Climate of History, where Chakrabarty writes that the mansion of modern freedoms stands on an ever-expanding base of fossil fuel use. What struck me so much over the past 3 weeks is that the West wants this to be a war about modern freedoms. We don't really want to see any connection between those things and oil and power and violence. The only connection we want to see between our lives and the lives of others is that where we are now, they will be soon. They want to be like us. They're becoming like us. That's the story of progress. And that's a way of cleansing from our gaze the extent to which the lives of others are as they are in order to make possible the lives that we have had around here lately. So we want to believe that everyone in the world wants to be like us and could be like us if it wasn't for bad men like Putin. Our moral comfort rests on the idea that what we have now is what everyone will have later, rather than that what we have now is made possible by what others have now. And it feels to me as though the failure of this fantasy is playing out in real time. You know, there was literally a day when, if you followed the news, European leaders were debating in public whether or not they could afford to make a moral choice to boycott oil and gas from Russia. And the next morning, surprise, the headline was, Russia plans to cut off oil and gas to Europe. Like we don't make the connection of our dependence, our comfort, at the very literal level of our ability to heat our homes, is dependent on what we claim to deplore. And this is probably something we need to come back to further down the line. But when Reed writes about the haunted mansion of modern freedom, as well as that Chakrabarty quote, it brings back to me Vanessa Andreotti's image of the house modernity built. So I guess I just want to invite us to sit with a recognition that part of what's going on in this war is that we're experiencing the continuing slow collapse of that house, that mansion in which we were brought up to believe we lived.
It's funny, I mean, the title of our original Future Noughts stage show 6 or 7 years ago that preceded the podcast was Power, Death and Money. Well, we actually explored, you know, that concatenation of challenges around energy, geopolitics, war and finance. And I think the culture war that's flaring up here in the UK now is around net zero and the role of nuclear and renewables versus more drilling for oil in the waters around the UK and fracking. And that's all obviously trying to address these big emerging issues of energy security and stability and sustainability and independence. But it also completely misses the point that all of these options have costs, you know, to bolster that house of modernity, where those costs can be direct or indirect, individual or collective. And, you know, I find myself asking the question, is dependence on Chinese rare earth metals for dramatically scaled renewable technologies any more secure than a reliance on conflict energy, whether that comes from home or abroad in the form of fossil fuels. And for me, that's when the foundations of modernity's house really start to shake.
Absolutely. You know, this is the intuition that I've been trying to bring into view in the book that I'm writing, is that, you know, often when we have what looks like a division between two sides opposed to each other in the way we're describing the world right now, it's a way of not looking at the complex truth that would show us really how deep a mess we're in, because we divide that truth and we only focus on the part of it which we can blame on our opponents. And, you know, like the cost, the real cost of, you know, living through and finding ways of living through the end of, you know, through the hospicing of modernity, as Vanessa puts it, like that's a thing that, you know, none of us wants to think about. But part of where that becomes paralyzing is that we easily then start zooming out and trying to think about at some kind of big God's eye view where we are and what needs to be done. And, you know, you talked earlier about that sense of wanting to do something. And I think the starting point of what can you do, I think it always has to involve coming back from the fantasy of surveying the world from above. Like, it may be helpful sometimes to act as if we can think and talk and speak from that place of perspective, but we are, you know, our lives are embodied. We are where we are, when we are. And if you start from that, the answer to what can you do, you know, the honest answer may be not a huge amount. Or it may be that it starts with, you know, stilling yourself and waiting until you catch sight of the small thing that you can do. Clearly, there are ways that you can support people in Ukraine, in Yemen, in Syria, elsewhere. There are organizations that you can raise money for. Justin Smith has some good links in his latest post. You can also help to create a culture where refugees and asylum seekers are welcome. A long time ago, when I lived in Sheffield, I was around the beginnings of City of Sanctuary, which is a movement that spread from there. It's a movement that's deeply inspired me over the years. If we can broaden out the compassion that is being shown for Ukrainian refugees and use it to strengthen that grassroots culture of sanctuary, that would be a good thing to contribute to, a good thing to bring out of a time like this. You can also take responsibility for being your own small pocket of peace within the world. Gordon White was talking about this the other week. He said, you don't pray for peace. You pray peace. You bring yourself into alignment with the field of peace rather than the field of war. Spending too much of your time strung out in doom scrolling, allowing horrors that you can't do much about to overwhelm your consciousness, inhabiting online spaces that are themselves structured around conflict and escalation, it's not going to bring more peace into the world. So switch off, walk away from the screen, take your headphones off, go looking for Wendell Berry's Peace of Wild Things.
I'm so glad you said that, because that's pretty much what I've been doing every day along the river here. I woke up at dawn the other morning, and in the soft light, the heron was fishing down the river, and it's only the second time I've seen it doing that on my bit of the river in the year I've lived here. And yeah, Wendell Berry was immediately foremost in my mind.
Yeah. And you know, wherever you are, you might not have a river outside your doorstep or fields a few minutes walk away like we have here, but it is there waiting for you. That piece of wild things, even if it's only a patch of scruffy bushes or a magpie building a nest in a tree in the school playground. I went for a walk across the fields here at the start of this week, and the larks were singing in the air. Whatever we do, however much mess we make of the world, the spring just comes. In Sweden at this time of year, it's not uncommon to see someone just standing on a street corner their eyes closed and their face lifted towards the sun, taking a few minutes to gather its warmth. Whatever the horrors in the news feeds and the bulletins, there's something about the spring that's hard to resist. Why would you even want to?
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. If you'd like to follow the threads in our conversations further, head over to homewardbound.org, where you'll also find my Substack, Writing Home. You'll find us on Facebook as The Great Humbling, and Ed is at FruCool on Twitter. We're always glad to hear from those of you who are listening, and we're deeply grateful for all that our listeners do to spread the word and bring these conversations to new ears by sharing the podcast along your networks and giving it ratings or reviews on the platforms where you listen. These are strange and humbling times, and we need quiet corners, breathing spaces, air pockets and pockets of resistance, places in which to puzzle through how we got here and where we might be going. Thank you for helping us create one of those pockets.